I think Shakespeare's a great reference, sure, but like he doesn't, the stuff just doesn't, the language is outdated, it feels archaic, and I don't understand a reason to give children, I don't understand any other reasons to give children other than, oh, like he's just highly revered throughout centuries and that's why we should read him. Like I don't, how does that connect with them in their communities? How does that connect to them in their backgrounds?
Yeah, and as you were talking about us needing, because Nick, you just critiqued Shakespeare on the Home Base podcast. I'm just sitting with that now. I'm just sitting with that. Yeah. But maybe we'll get some work from the Orange Line poet.
Yeah, definitely.
That we can put in our classrooms so we don't have to read Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Any updates?
Welcome to the Home Base podcast, the podcast where we explore the keys to college success and personal growth. I'm your host, Dr. Ricky Pope, and today we're deep diving into how students can survive and thrive in their college journey. For this first series, we're collaborating with the Young Men of Color Alliance, an organization committed to supporting young men of color through mentorship and community initiatives. Today's episode will focus on giving you the tools and strategies to take control of your academic experience. We will discuss the importance of developing agency and the power to make choices, shape your future, and overcome obstacles. Welcome to the Home Base Podcast.
Welcome to the Home Base Podcast, where today's episode promises an inspiring and insightful conversation with Nick Martin, the Orange Line poet. Nick, known for his powerful spoken word pieces and deep community engagement, is currently a part of the community-based block program. His poetry often explores themes of mental health, identity, community resilience, resonating widely and earning recognition from platforms like Soft Magazine and SDSU. Join us as we dive into Nick's poetic journey, explore his inspirations, and discuss the transformative role poetry can play in an individual and community healing. Welcome to the Home Base Podcast.
Hey, appreciate you having me on. I'm glad to be back. Yeah, there's a lot that I've been doing the last few months as far as my program, my grad school program, and some of my writing, and some of my speaking engagements too, also. So it's been pretty busy.
So, you know, so the Home Base Podcast, you know, we have a wide range of folks who listen, and it's about college success. And so I'm thinking about like some maybe undergrad students who may be thinking about graduate school. So I don't want you to scare them away. But how is graduate school going for you? What is it? What's the difference between undergrad and a master's program? And
I will say for graduate school, the work is different as far as what we are focusing on most of the time. You know, in undergrad, you have your GEs and all those things to start off with. And depending on whether you're starting at a community college or a four-year university, that also impacts how you approach your academic journey. I'd say for me, I'm enjoying grad school more than I did undergrad, which is a common sentiment, I think. But also my undergrad experience was a little bit different because it's centered on economics. My bachelor's was in economics, and now I'm currently in a multicultural counseling and social justice education program. And so I had a social justice lens for economics, and so I think that's where I bridged the gap between the two. But they are different worlds because the way econ approaches or sees the world is different than how counselors or therapists will see the world or society in general. And so I think I'm taking in financial status, class, all these things into multicultural counseling and understanding like the different levels and stressors that come with currently living in a financial crisis that we're in now, that, you know, has been perpetual especially for people born after, you know, the year 2000, especially. It's just constant perpetual crisis in America with the recession because of the housing bubble, the pandemic, which caused some stagflation, and then we get into the current recession that we're in now. So there's a lot of uncertainty, I think, with how our country will prosper or prevail. And I think that also impacts students in whether or not they even want to pursue education. My idea is that it's great to pursue it if you have the opportunity to. But it's definitely shifting some people's perspectives on whether or not anything is worth it. It's getting very existential out here, to say the least.
Yeah, no, some part of how society, current day events are unfolding, like, it feels absurd. Like, what is this? Mm-hmm. You can't do that. That's not supposed to be a thing. That's not the way we used to do it. But I guess going back to your point about the stagflation, the inflation, the pandemic, like the changing social political landscape, like, damn it. Like, how do young men and how do all students that are coming of age, right? Like, how do you find your way at 18, right? And like, know what to do. And then also for students in your position, grad students, like, how do you do this? This is really hard.
It is a lot. And especially in the program that I'm in, you know, we're constantly working on our group dynamics. Mm-hmm. And that in itself takes a lot of energy. And I believe what's currently happening within my cohort is feeling like we have to choose between doing the internal emotional work that's involved with group dynamics and our own therapy, like seeking out our own therapy, versus just being a cognitive academic who only focuses on the schoolwork and doesn't even entertain the idea of.
Okay, so what you're saying is you're in a cohort of like 20 plus people?
Or 30 people.
30 total. People. Mm-hmm. And you get to decide about like how you want to take in information?
Yeah, that's the thing. So we do get to decide ultimately as individuals. The hope, I believe, as a collective is that we really take the time to take advantage of this rare opportunity to have a unique experience with education in general, with it being a student-led master's program. Mm-hmm. Like, we make our own syllabi for all the courses. Our input is the input that is weighed, I'd say, equal and sometimes even more compared to faculty when it comes to how we approach assignments and things. Of course, there's some limitations that we do have being a part of San Diego State University, but I think ultimately we're both faculty and students are just working together to find practices that can help give us agency at the end of the day so we can equip our clients as well as other community members with that same sense of agency.
And so the ultimate goal of this, I guess, community-based block program, what is the goal that's going to...
Well, the motto for CBB is to lean into discomfort. Mm-hmm. And so by leaning into discomfort, we are leaning into conflict, leaning into uncomfortable conversations, leaning to the truth, whatever that is, leaning into what it is we want out of our lives. Leaning into authenticity, leaning into risk-taking, leaning into not knowing what the future holds, but leaning into the future. Mm-hmm. And if we are taking the time to be empowered and not second-guess ourselves as much as we would prior to being a part of the program, I think all 30 of us will be successful, whether we choose to be LPCC's licensed practitioners or if we choose to go a different route with our careers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from this program, what's the most significant thing that you've learned or learned about yourself?
I learned that my involvement or lack thereof can hurt people regardless.
Mm.
And I'm more significant than I think I am in spaces, even if I am in the background. And I think also something I've learned, or I'm learning, I'm trying to get my train of thought back, but I think it just has to do with desiring authenticity and desiring to be who I am and take the risk of not being liked and being alone or being or having folks disagree with me, but like still choosing to embrace me.
Now that sounds really scary.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
People not liking me, people disagreeing with me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but you share that as if that's a virtuous quality.
Yeah.
Say more.
Because I think there's, I can't say it for everyone. I can say for myself that I have lost or dehumanized my own self by kind of just blending in.
Mm-hmm.
And not really seeing my value in the past, and taking more steps and strides towards my own humanization, my own like ability to just be and not perform.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that will take me further than, and will get me to where I want to get to more than I think, you know, most things will.
Mm-hmm.
I think connections are great, and I think they're very valuable. And I don't really think I'd be currently in the place that I am without the connections I've made since community college.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the other side of the work is myself, and I think that, you know, leading up to the program, I felt like I was making strides towards being more of myself and knowing what that means. Because people always talk about, oh, be yourself. But like, I don't know what that means. How would I know what that means if I'm catering to other people's needs and wants from me? Like, I don't know what being myself means if that's the case. So I'm in this space with 30 other people, plus faculty, where I get to just experiment and really use it as a lab to be like, I'm just going to be this way today and see what happens. Or I'm going to take a bet on myself and see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to feel weird. I'm going to talk about stuff that I don't even tell my family in front of these people, you know, to like build self-esteem, to build worth, to have new ideas of who I am, like how I can, to prove to myself how I can show up in conflict and things.
As you're talking, I kind of think about how sometimes, you know, just existing on the planet, you can have dehumanizing experiences. But as you're talking about this program that you're enrolled in, sounds like some part of it is a rehumanization process. Yeah, for you.
Absolutely. One of the sites that we have our classes at is at the continuing education site in Southeast San Diego. And it's not far from Mount Hope Cemetery, where my mom is buried and my aunt is also buried there.
Mm.
And so one of the students offered to like just go with me, just to like go and just visit them. And she brought flowers and things. And then once she mentioned that she was gonna go during lunch, other people were like, oh, I wanna go. And I remember just being there, and it was a sunny day, it was very surreal. Just looking at all the people around me that just cared about me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that I expressed in that moment was, like, I feel like I have to do something to, like, pay y'all back for, like, I just, it's just innate feeling that I have. Mm-hmm. But, like, it just, they assured me, like, that that's not the case in that moment. And then I also learned, like, how nice it is just to get love, just to get it without really doing anything for mm-hmm. it. Which I think especially for men, it seems like we have to do in order to get love. We have to do in order to be validated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why the relationship between a son and their mom is so important, because I think a lot of times we have this belief colloquially, like this colloquial agreement that our moms are going to be the only ones that really love us. And for regardless of what happens, we could wind up in prison, but she'll still want to visit us, put money on our books, mm-hmm. do everything she can to, you know, be there for us. And I think in that moment, it was cool to just not just have to rely on my mom for comfort. And the ironic part about it is that my mom was, her ashes were just buried right next to me when that all took place, along with my aunt. Who also, unfortunately, you know, passed away at a young age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she has three kids, three, four kids. So, yeah.
Mm. I guess I'm sitting with the significance of your cohort, of these other master's level students who are training to be therapists, you know, going with you to the cemetery and being there, and the significance of that, and kind of what you said about like love. It's almost like without like strength, like unconditional positive regard, or mm-hmm. like just loving on people just to love on them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how special that is, and kind of how I guess that can be gendered. Yeah. And yeah, and sometimes men don't get that, and sometimes I guess we didn't know we needed that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I feel like for me, like, you know, I think I talked about briefly, I think it was with a couple of our undergrad students about like my mom passing away while I was in my last semester of undergrad. And like, I didn't have time to grieve because I had a semester left and I needed to graduate, and family were checking on me, trying to see when I was going to graduate. You know, I had calc theory that I need to take for a third time, and if I didn't pass, I wasn't graduating. So there was just a lot of stress, and I'd been in undergrad for the total of 7 years at that point. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a lot weighing on me. Like, it really just hit me that I'm like an alumni, like last semester, you know, and I graduated in 2023, so it's just, you know. So I think like, as a man and other folks, I think this, we have 8 billion people on the planet and we still feel like we're supposed to do stuff alone. Like, I just, something, the message was lost somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know how far back, I don't know where exactly, but it's just like, I really just don't believe that's even feasible. Or I just don't think that makes sense. I think there's studies on how people that feel othered or just ostracized in their communities that they're in typically will show more symptoms of other mental health symptoms because of that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that if someone's othered, then they have mental health challenges. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying what being othered does to someone, you know, I don't think we really understand the depth of that until it's too late. Mm-hmm. And we're wondering how this happened to them.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah, the otherization. And so it makes me think of like kind of parallel to that, like longitudinal studies looking at like adult development. I think I was at Harvard. And then the power of connections and relationships, and that those individuals who went through their life with good quality relationships often said that life was good and they had the things that they needed. And so it's a predictor of quality of life, right? Having mm-hmm. good relationships. And then you have the Surgeon General that comes with this report, right, about loneliness, yeah. right? So, I mean, just to kind of highlight what you're saying, you get otherized, right? You're lonely and otherized. That's a yeah. lot of stuff. And so it's like, how do we bring people? And so I guess I feel like really, you know, touched by the experience that you're sharing, because just how things are unfolding in the world, we're going to need some counselors now.
Yeah. I was thinking about that, like, either earlier this week or last week. I was like, goodness gracious, like, the our happiness ranking as a nation is way lower than what it was. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think there's this feeling of, in the air, at least for me, that I'm sensing is like this feeling of anger, regret, resentment, blame shifting. Like, it just seems very chaotic. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, media blasts of planes crashing every other 2 seconds is not helping. Mm-hmm. Media blasts of, you know, things that the current president will put into paper or print out or whatever, or email or send out, like, just saying it's official is not helping, because mm-hmm. people are taking it as official law and it's not. So it's causing mass hysteria. You know, it's like, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie. It was on Netflix, the Obamas produced it. And it's really eerie and interesting how some of what's happening in that movie, I think, is currently happening with the confusion mm-hmm. that is taking place across communities and cultures and blame shifting. I really need to remember that movie. I can't think of it off the top of my head, but yeah, I think Mahershala Ali was in it, and it was basically like a post-apocalyptic film. Mm-hmm. Planes were falling out the sky, mm-hmm. right? You know, satellites were down or whatever. I think we're so privileged in America, because in the movie there is a scene where this ship just runs up on this beach shore and no one does anything. And like, to me, I was like, are they getting invaded? And like, nobody did anything, because mm-hmm. it's like I remember being at Coronado Beach, I think last year, and it was way different from when I was a kid. Like, there was a dog park or dog beach section, but ever since I think the war in Ukraine started, there's been a lot more military drills happening near there. Mm-hmm. And so people aren't taking their dogs because the dogs are afraid of the noises that the helicopters make and all those other things. Like, it's like, we are, as beautiful as Hotel Del Coronado is, it's right next to, you know, military practices. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I don't think we are, as a collective, really understanding what that means as far as what we do for grassroots organizing, what that even means. I think Malcolm X said something about that being out organized, and it just seems like we're severely out organized on several levels. And when I say we, I really just mean like the American people. I don't care what your political stance is. Mm-hmm. I just feel like our rights are being taken away, right? You know, right before us. There's students who are legal students here that are getting their citizenship status revoked just for practicing their right for freedom of speech, which I think is outrageous. So, yeah, it's just a very bleak time. And I'm really hoping that there's going to be work that we do intentionally, like just thinking locally, because I can only think as far as the scope that I'm currently in right now.
Yeah,
just,
one of my mentors, Dr. Morris, he would always talk about controlling your turf.
Yeah.
Right, control your local community, control the local politics. And so as you're speaking, what's resonating with you on the local level?
The first thing that just comes to mind before I even say anything is just like building trust and what that looks like. Mm-hmm. Like people just need to know that. I think there's like a saying, like people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, yeah, I mean, I think people just want to wake up, do what they need to do to get by, get home safe to their family or to their dog or whoever, and just do it again.
Yeah, and maybe that's a common place for us to start, like, building connection. Like, you're right, like, I always think, like, man, like, I used to say, you know, I want to, you know, watch our kids, you know, play football, and you know, but I think it's soccer now. And so when I, you know, take my daughter and I look down the sidelines and I see all the people from all different backgrounds and everything, yeah, it's like that shared identity, like as and so how do we find those shared touch points of connection?
And I'm really glad you brought up that example, because that example brings multiple different demographics into one place just to support their children, right? It's like you have people with a lot of power in the city as far as like, you know, political power and other things showing up, or people with connections to them showing up. You have all just people of all different backgrounds coming together and just recognizing like the purpose in them being there, and just to love on their children, to really just be present.
Maybe yell at a referee or two.
right. And, you know, like brag about your kid at the end of the day. And I think that's wonderful. Like I think about just like the gift that is. Like I'm just thinking about that movie again, because it's like we just, you know, there's so much that America doesn't have to face compared to other countries as far as like war on physical, like war on our turf, or on our territory, on mainland USA. And it's like I just look at what's happening in other countries across the world, and just people being, you know, killed, kids being killed, all these things, and, you know, people being separated from their family, or fleeing to another country just to not die, and how scary that is, and whether or not they know the language of the place they're moving to, do they have enough, like, there's too much, like, the amount of anxiety I'm getting just talking about it is just, I wouldn't want to have to go through that. You know, I was born and raised in San Diego, you know, I think I'm technically like a third generation San Diegan, which is like crazy, because people are always surprised to say that I'm even born and raised here. So it's just like, oh yeah, like my grandparents were both here, and yeah. And then my parents, both of them grew up here. Like it's wild. So like I have that privilege in itself of just being able to, like, you know, not have to worry about my citizenship status being revoked as of now, right? I don't know.
Hey, man, come on. I mean, hey, listen.
I don't know.
You stop giving them ideas now.
Right. I know, right? Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. When I was thinking about running, like watching my daughter run up and down the field, I was thinking about like an experience that you just shared with me. And I guess you give sermons on the weekend or something?
Oh, like sometimes, yeah. So like I had a youth service to deliver a sermon for, like I was asked to do. And yeah, it was pretty good. And I always like it when I have friends just like come and support me, just because like they might not even go to church or anything, but like they just go and support me just because it's Nick. You know, and I really appreciate them for that. So like, yeah, I think it's wonderful.
Now this is the family business now.
Yeah, technically yes. So like the place that I preached at was not my dad's church, but it was within the organization that my dad's church is in. So it's still the family business, but like imagine like a jewelry store, and the uncle owns the store, and the nephew goes and like negotiates at another store, basically, rather than selling at the shop that day.
But I was just thinking about, like, you know, how your father may, you know, I don't know your dad now, but I'm assuming he's proud of you running up and down the field, right? Like preaching and following in his footsteps in your own kind of way.
Yeah. Yeah. He's expressed that. And that was good to hear him say, like, publicly, like he introduced me before I went up. The last time I did my sermon, it was a couple weeks ago. So that felt really good, felt really affirming. Yeah, it's just really powerful to be able to hear that from your dad. Because I think at the beginning of this show, we were talking about how we're trying to find, where do undergrad students find themselves in college? And I always just wonder about how they got here, who their parents are. Do they feel pressure from their parents to perform? Do they feel pressure from their parents at all? What are the dynamics? Are they paying their parents' rent? Are they the breadwinner of their family? Like, there's a lot of questions to ask.
Paying your parents' rent.
Yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah, that's wild.
Or sometimes they have kids of their own that they got to look out for, and then they're still young. Like, there's a lot happening.
I mean, college is hard.
Yeah, it's so already hard.
Yeah.
Like, take all those things out. College is already crazy, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm just thinking about that. And the various stories I've heard from people on how resilient they were to get through what they got through. And I think about, like, you know, my dad just saying that about me, like the positive things about me publicly before I went up was just, I needed to hear that. So it was.
What did that mean to you? Because, you know, and, you know, sometimes as men, right, we don't express that. Like, when you were talking about, like, your cohort coming there to the Mount Hope.
Yeah, yeah.
And not realizing that you needed that. And like, man, hey, can I give you something?
Right. It felt like a dream being there. It was really surreal. Like, I just, I really hope people, I really want that to just be a thing. Like, you just have a bunch of people just pull up to the site that you're grieving. Like, the way it looked, like, my perspective, it really felt like a dream. Like, it just, it didn't feel real to me. I didn't know how to, like, react or respond. I literally just told them how I felt in that moment and how I was, like, I don't know how to, like, you know, say thank you enough. Like, this is so different for me of, like, people really taking, like, the time to, like, intentionally, like, care for me without any... And you were like just doing it just to do it. And so I think that was important for me. And then that ties back into my dad, just like, you know, in the roles that he played in raising me, you know, I think there's that thing of wanting validation or approval from parents, regardless of your relationship with them. My relationship with my dad, like, I think regardless of how it's gone so far, like, it's still something I want. I still want approval for him. Even when I try to, like, shake it, like, I just want to, like, not have that. Like, I wish I could just approve myself all the time. But it just felt really good to just hear what he said. And it still feels good to have, you know, other people affirm me and every now and then. Like, not living and dying by people's opinions about me. Mm-hmm. But, like, when I really need it, like, I don't discount it. I don't discredit it. I don't fight it off. I don't say, well, but none of that. Like, I just hold it as much as I can so I can disrupt those patterns of negative self-talk or being hard on myself or things like that.
Negative self-talk? What's that?
You know, like, I think we're just hard on ourselves inherently. Like, I think a part of Noam Chomsky wrote this book called Requiem of the American Dream that I think explains a lot of the reasons why we are the way we are and why we feel like we have to do things by ourselves. And it's a book I tend to reference pretty often because these conversations come up pretty often because things do get very existential. But anyway, the negative self-talk piece, I believe, is because we feel like we have to. If we're not working, we're worthless. And that's the design of the system that we work in. The system that we work in, at least for the United States, is that our value is in the work that we produce. Mm-hmm. How profitable are we? How productive are we? And there's been science to back up how productive people can be. And there's been machines created since, you know, chattel slavery and before on increasing productivity and like investing in that and like doubling down on that. And I think the sad part is we think that we're finding new ways to liberate ourselves by gaining new technology, but we're working harder than probably we ever have in like human history. Like the stuff that we're doing, like just emails alone, right? Like I know there, people say, oh, it's just emails, but it's not just emails, because the amount of communication we would do in an hour through emails prior to that would take a lot of time. Like I can't even measure that, because I was not even conceived even in that time period, nor was my dad, or maybe he was. I'm trying to think. The internet, email, 90s. So for me. Mm-hmm. But for him, he kind of knew what that was like. But I'm just saying, like, there's so much, like, work that we're doing, and I don't think we're really processing or giving ourselves enough credit of just, like, we're actually pretty advanced, like, as a society. Like, just giving ourselves credit for that. But, like, in the book that Noam Chomsky, Requiem for the American Dream, he talks about how, like, we are supposed to want to do things alone by ourselves. Like, in economics, they say that the perfect consumer or the ideal consumer is one that lives alone, buys everything in the house for themselves, doesn't rely on anyone else. And it's just like, why is that the perfect consumer? And like in that terminology, they're a perfect consumer because that means company XYZ gets the most money out of one person. If they can get the most money out of 300 million individuals, then that means they're all going to make more money. If you have people living in houses, roommates, double family homes, we always talk about single family homes, but double family homes, what about that? What about duplexes? All these other like living situations, it takes away from that power structure. Mm. And I think the sad part about it is that we're made to feel bad if we live in those kind of environments. And the crazy thing is that I don't really think it's that crazy, but it's interesting how you have families, especially families who have immigrated to this country, that have been able to do well by using that system of living together for a generation or two, building up the money they need to build so they can support themselves and so that their kids don't have to work as hard or work as excruciating, as many excruciating hours that they had to. So yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, people always kind of try to say America's like a melting pot, and it's I don't believe it is. I think it's just, it's more of a gumbo. There's a lot of chunky bits and pieces in this thing, and I think we're all just wanting to just survive as best as we can and live some kind of ideal life where we can wake up and not worry about war and wake up and just be, you know, take a walk, like just look at, you know, nature, look at trees and feel the sun, you know, breathe clean air, drink clean water, just like basic needs. It's just, yeah, stuff. I think the reason why I'm saying all these things is because I think earlier also I was saying how existential stuff can get. And I think for students who do want to pursue their undergraduate education as well as their graduate education, and this is something I learned from somebody, they said that you get the chance to be translators for your community. Mm. So whatever information that you learn, you get to take with you, do your research, do whatever it is you got to do to get your degree, right? And then you understand the knowledge now. Like for me, I'm going to have the knowledge that I wanted, that I went to school for, so I can help my people. Like I understand the economic disparities that exist in the Black communities, and I understand the repercussions and the political dynamics that are currently at play because of it. As I don't have enough time to explain all that, but hopefully listeners understand. But I went into econ, initially business, but econ, to be like, okay, I just need to know how money works, how policies and stuff work, so I can help my people. That's it. Mm-hmm. And now I'm at this phase now where I'm in the mental health space and I'm trying to do the same thing. and I get to be a translator to people. And not saying that they don't have the knowledge or the wherewithal themselves to just research stuff on the internet, because life's an open book test now. Everybody got the internet, right? Mm-hmm. But at least I can share my experiences from school. At least I can share my experiences from the people that I've met, the faculty I've met, the students I've met, the people that have made direct change, how I can help with it. So
one of the things that you kind of talked about.
Got Enoch coming in, see if the door's unlocked. Oh, you good? All right then, brother. I'll see you. All right then. Wait, what were you saying?
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that you kind of talked about was kind of how, like, your life intersects. Like, just because you're a college student doesn't mean that life at home is on pause. So there's all this stuff that's unfolding. So you're coming of age across community college and at the university, and life continues in grad school. So I'm just curious of, like, how, you know, through your early 20s here, your emerging adulthood years, as we call it, in developmental psychology, like, how has academia, the university, campus life influenced your development as a young man?
No, I really like this question, and I really like how you said life continues in the grad school. I think we have this idea that life starts, or life can start, once we get the degree, once we get the job, once we get... And I think we're just delaying so much greatness with this kind of frame of thinking. I really hope for myself, but for others as well, like, we get to really just relish in where our feet are. Just be where your feet are and be like, my life has started now. Like, I'm really just wanting to push that we're going to get older. We're going to be 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. And as we're fortunate to be those ages, what do we want to say about, like, what happened? Like, what did we do? And, like, were we waiting on somebody to give us permission to start living? Like, I just don't think we should. And I feel like I'm answering your question. I know that there were some other things that you asked, but that was just the first thing that came to mind.
Well, piggybacking on what you're saying is, one of past guests, Alexis Dixon, he always talks about, can I self-authorize myself? Am I self-authorized, right? Who asks for permission to start living?
Right.
Right. And so, like, as I'm listening to you, it really sounds like you're a self authorized individual.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying. Yeah. That's that. Thank you. Like, I accept that. I receive that. I think I grew up knowing that, not to be morbid, but we don't know what day or time or anything, like, when time's up for us individually. Like, I really just care about, I want to care about and love the people that I love daily, or as much as I can, without straining myself to the point or depleting myself to the point of not loving myself. But I just want to live in a way where I feel humanized, and the self-authorization just feels like a term that makes sense to me. Like, being authorized, like, to do, to act, to take charge, to take action, even when things are uncertain, or if we don't know what the potential outcome could be. Like, there's a lot of trailblazers in education that came before me that made it possible for me to get the Pell Grant so I can, like, have a lot of my education paid off, right? Like, there's just so many people that really, really just wanted better for everyone, and they just wanted... They wanted that too for their own family and friends that would possibly go down the same academic route. And I don't know if they knew exactly what the outcome would be, but they tried. And so I think for me, like, I don't want to be afraid to try. I don't want to be afraid of conflict, even though I still am. I don't want to be not trusting myself. I just don't want to not trust myself. I have to live with myself daily. Like, I choose to live with myself daily, I should say. Mm-hmm. I choose to live with myself daily, which means that I choose to trust myself daily. And if I feel like I'm not trusting myself or my decisions, it's like, what am I doing? And I think those are the things that I'm learning. And I'm also just very grateful for the people that came before me who have helped me on my journey, who have influenced me in the right direction, that have changed the trajectory of my life to just try and not worry too much about what everyone else has to say. Because at the end of the day, everyone has an agenda for our lives. And sometimes that agenda can be in alignment with what I want, and sometimes not. But I have to understand that, because when I do get advice or when I am recommended things, I understand that whatever it is that they're giving me is coming from their lens. And they don't know 100% of what I've been through, 100% of my knowledge, none of that. So I can take it, you know, if it's beneficial, cool. If it's not, then I just need to, like, you know, rest on it, maybe come back to it later. But I just feel like I just want to trust myself more than right now. It's kind of like, you know, when people go on diets and they're like, oh, that didn't work for me, but everyone's saying this is the best diet. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know your body more than anyone else. You know when you're about to get sick. You know, like, personally me, like, my joints are now starting to hurt whenever it's about to rain.
Damn it, I know. Already?
Yeah. So, like, I know it's about to rain because my knees hurt now. So mm-hmm. It's like, that's the thing. It's like, I know myself enough, and that's where the trust is built within myself. Like, I have a firm idea of what works for me now, and it's a lovely place once I get there. Like, if I had some of this insight 10 years ago, like, things would have been different, but I don't know if I'd be currently here. Like, it would have changed also, like, my path. So I'm grateful that I went through what I went through despite everything. But yeah,
how do you balance personal vulnerability with your storytelling, spoken word, sermons that you give? Like, how do you put all that together?
Balancing it is just like knowing to connect. And it's funny because this is actually one of the theories in therapy. I'm trying to remember. I think it might be Gestalt or one of the others, but balance, or no, I think it's CBT. Cognitive behavioral therapy is being able to balance the mind, emotion, and then there's like one third component that I'm forgetting. And you can cut me off and let me know if I'm... But I think, I think poetry is a cool way to educate people. Same way music is a cool way to educate people. I think one of the things that is a disservice to our education is, I think Shakespeare's a great reference, sure, but like the language is outdated, it feels archaic, and I don't understand a reason to give children, I don't understand any other reasons to give children other than, oh, like, he's just highly revered throughout centuries and that's why we should read him. Like, how does that connect with them in their communities? How does that connect to them in their backgrounds? You know, I think about Kendrick Lamar and how he's been used in several classrooms, even in some of the stuff I taught at the Black Excellence Symposium. Mm-hmm. You know, using someone that's more current, who has a very diverse background, who came from where he came from, and is still able to balance the mind, body, spirit aspects of his music. And so I think with what I do with poetry and sermons and my education is that they all kind of coalesce to be some component of that. I feel like that's a holistic approach to the human, because we're not always cognitive, we're not always emotional, we're not always spiritual, but I think those three components do communicate to each other. I think sometimes the body knows what we're feeling before our mind does. It's like we'll have bodily reactions, body language, all these things. And we're we're not even realizing we're doing, like, the amount of legs that shake in class. Mm-hmm. I know you've probably seen a bunch of times, but people just shaking their legs. Like, what is that, right? And so sometimes it's nothing, but sometimes it is something. Maybe there's a test that they're worried about. Maybe something happened. Maybe there was a breakup that, like, there's so many things that happen. And there's energy that's in our body that's trying to get out and exhibit itself. And it's really hard because we're in these settings where the banking system of education is taking place, and we have to just do that for the next hour and a half.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes you have to do what you have to do to survive the course.
Yeah.
So these are lessons for life, you know.
Yeah.
And so it makes me connecting to Kendrick Lamar and the concept of the great American game.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, when I was a kid, you know, the idea was you got to learn how to play the game. And so what is the great American game?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that ties into the book I mentioned earlier, too, which is funny. I think it's just like not pushing the envelope to the point where stuff has to change, like protecting democracy in a way that keeps stuff the same without any progress, but you can get your own benefits from it and, like, you know, exploit the system in however way you want for it to work for you and yourself. And then that's, I think that's like, in that Super Bowl performance, I think that's kind of what Uncle Sam, played by Samuel L. Jackson, which I think is funny, was kind of exhibiting. Like, when Kendrick played a more pop song,
mm-hmm.
he was like, okay, you're doing good. That's exactly what we want to hear, all these mm-hmm. things, right? Mm-hmm. And I think America kind of purposely, politically, and in a lot of different ways, but I think especially politically, will dilute things in a way that will make us question and wonder, like, do I really want to challenge authority right now? Is it worth losing my secure job to challenge authority? Is it worth losing the house? Is it worth losing the things I worked for? And that's that thing that we come into conflict with. I come into conflict with, like, every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's something that the great American game presents to us. It's like, if you play the game, you have a chance to be successful. You have a chance to be wildly successful.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a chance to be considered regular, considered a nobody, which I don't think is true, but those are the labels that we're given. Or you have the chance of just not playing at all and you're outcasted, you're othered, like we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why Kendrick is so great, because he chose to play songs that, you know, weren't necessarily his most popular songs ever. Most of them were newer songs that people were still learning, but they all played into the narrative he was portraying of just doing it his way on his accord. It was within the system of the Super Bowl. It was within the confine of that, but he was able to do what he needed to do in that context. I have a cousin who always says it takes all types. And I think when it comes to liberatory practices, when it comes to revolutionary practices, it takes all types to make things happen. You have people who are considered to be more radical. You have people who are considered to be more moderate. And so I think if you are able to find middle ground between those two groups, especially, which through our history is presented itself to be kind of difficult, I think you can really find something really, like, a sweet spot that really, really works, that can really create progress. Because I always just think about, like, W.E.B. Du Bois versus Garvey, you know, Fred Hampton's and all these, like, with the Rainbow Coalition, which reminds me a lot about Bankin's Rebellion, mm-hmm. and how those are, history repeats itself, and it's just so crazy how it shows up in different mediums.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think they just have a way of doing things that challenges status quo, that works for them, that is in alignment with their values, their core beliefs, and they're doing it with the people in mind. Like, they do care about who they're serving. Like, the whole idea of public servant and what that means, like, we have all these elected officials, and this is something my dad always talks about how elected officials are public servants, and it really just doesn't feel like that's what that is anymore. Mm-hmm. At least on a federal level. I can't speak to local level, at least not in the way I can right now. But it just really just feels like a show. And I think America itself has a wonderful PR team. We have all these people thinking America is this grand country that has all these things. But it's just like, these are things to like soothe or soften. It's like the whole bread and circuses idea. I think there's a lot of improvements that can take place across the board for us. Like the prices of medication going up, and like people not being able to afford medication for like diabetes or other things, like their insulin and stuff, and like choosing to just not take the medication because it's too expensive. And the result of that, like the ramifications for that, like it's just very, it's very dark to me. Like, it's very sad. Like, you have people who rely on these things, whether they're young or old, and it's like, just because of public servants who aren't really serving the public, choosing what to do with what and privatizing or profiting off of these resources that we really need, it's really sad. And it's like, the thing about the contradictions with American health, we have food apartheid. Mm-hmm. And we have all these, I walk into a grocery store, I'm like, I can't eat over half of the things that y'all have in here. Mm-hmm. Like, realistically, right? Mm-hmm. Like, of course I can consume it, but like the long-term effects of it is just not good. Like, how many of these ingredients are banned in other countries that mm-hmm. they just don't allow to be in the food? How many industries is America sustaining just to keep Red 40 alive? Mm-hmm. And it's like, those long-term effects of eating those things, and then us now having health issues because of it, and then turning a blind eye or just saying, oh, like, if they don't have insurance, if, you know, if the medicine's too expensive, tough luck. But it's like, you place the poison right there. And it's really sad, because some people do know better. And, you know, even then, can they afford the better food? Can they afford? How far is it? Cars are going to go up in price. Transportation, at least in San Diego, is public transportation is not that great. It takes 2 hours. If you live south of the 8 freeway, it takes 2 hours to get north of the 8 freeway. If you're trying to get to like San Carlos from Spring Valley, or like you have to take a bus, a trolley, another bus, the whole commute for a 15-minute drive for something that's on public transit is insane. So like, what does that mean for the people who live on their own, the perfect consumer who has to take public transit, carry all these bags, walk up and down these hills every day, work, school, whatever? Mm-hmm. What does that do to their health? Like, it just feels like we're walking we're just walking in circles with this, and we're just like, no wonder people feel the way they do. Like, I think we come into this thing called life feeling like we need to have an answer for what purpose is. But it's easy to get disillusioned once people realize what's going on. And I think the pandemic really just unveiled a lot of things, because we're realizing, oh, so we can like have all these things and like not have to worry about, you know, paying the lot. Like, I know it's crazy. But it's like, yeah, actually, like, it's just a game of Monopoly, it feels like. And I think with a game of Monopoly, and I think what happened with the United Health CEO, and then the person having Monopoly money in their backpack mm-hmm. in a park, in a location when the police found it, I just think it's just, you know... Yeah, that's kind of what it feels like. And that was also a person who's dealing with health issues. Yeah, and who's really young. He's my age. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's just frustrating. And I think with the anger and the frustration I feel, those are mobilizing emotions. I don't think we need to demonize anger or frustration and dilute it so we can help people feel comfortable. If it's coming up and it's coming up repetitively, then there's something that needs to give. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Man, you went deep today.
Yeah.
There's so many other questions I have and so many threads that you touched upon.
Part two, maybe. Because I do have class soon.
We might have to do part two.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, I was going to connect the Great American Game to the talk and Sundown Towns. We was about to go real deep.
Yeah.
But they'll have to tune in for the next one.
Yeah, for sure. And I hear that he's going to be releasing even more music soon. Mm-hmm. So that might also tie in. I'm not sure how valid that is, but he is going on tour soon. So
yeah, and as you were talking about us needing, because Nick, you just critiqued Shakespeare on the Home Base podcast. I'm just sitting with that now. Yeah. I'm just sitting with that. Yeah. But maybe we'll get some work from the Orange Line poet.
Yeah, definitely.
That we can put in our classrooms so we don't have to read Shakespeare.
Yeah, for sure. I got you.
Any updates?
As of right now, I won't say anything just yet. But yeah, I'm going to be still performing at open mics and things. The last show I headlined was for Poets Underground last year. So that was great. So there's a lot coming and a lot of writing I'm doing. So
excellent. And you'll be hosting the open mic at the Barbershop Talk?
Yes, I will be. Yeah. So that'll be April 17th.
Yeah. So from noon to 5. That's the issue. Gus and Emma BRC. So.
Yep.
All right. Well, listen, it was a pleasure as always sitting here with you on the Home Base podcast. So thanks for sitting down with me.
No, I appreciate you, Dr. Pope. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
The Home Base podcast is a student success podcast recorded at the Digital Humanities Center at San Diego State University Library. Like, follow, subscribe. Find us on IG at SDSU_homebase.